Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Kelly Palmer. Kelly Palmer is a thought leader on the future of learning and career development. Kelly recently joined the executive team at Degreed as Chief Learning Officer, where the mission is to help people embrace lifelong learning and discover and track personalized career development and all learning wherever it happens. Kelly was formerly the Chief Learning Officer of LinkedIn, where she was helping employees transform the trajectory of their careers through learning and development, driving the employee experience strategy, as well as leading inclusion and diversity for the company. Prior to LinkedIn, Kelly was VP of Learning at Yahoo, and also held executive positions in learning, M&A, and product development at Sun Microsystems. She's got a new book. It's co-written with David Blake, and it's called The Expertise Economy, How the Smartest Companies Use Learning to Engage, Compete, and Succeed. Kelly Palmer, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here today.
I was about halfway through your book when I realized that you and I had very similar epiphanies well into our professional careers, that overwhelmingly, the way our educational systems are structured from early childhood through K-12 into college, and even into the bulk of the corporate learning that we receive, it's not truly conducive to learning at all. We have the science that tells us how we best learn, and we have not changed our systems to match that understanding and that science. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And I think I had that epiphany not right away either. I think it wasn't until I got into corporate learning as a field that I really understood that we were using antiquated models for learning and that there were so much better ways to do that and that we weren't applying the science of what we knew about how we actually learn to what we do at all in the corporate world or in higher education in many cases either.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, I loved going to school. I was always a big reader. I really enjoyed my college experience. Until I was well into my, 25th, 26th year at Second City and was doing more on the education side of things and reading on the literature, I had no idea that we were basically using the kind of standardized testing and the formats, all of which don't match what we know. What I was curious about with you was that the thing to push you to write the book, or were you already in it and doing the change? You're like, oh, I got a book on this now.
Well, I think it was kind of an evolution where when I first got into corporate learning, I was pretty surprised at how antiquated a lot of how we were trying to help employees learn was. And then I had been involved in technology prior to getting into learning. And so, over the years, over the last 15 years or so, you've seen how much technology has evolved. And I think my thinking around learning and technology kind of came together along with this paradigm shift we're seeing in the world of work, around acceleration, things just happening so fast and, all these companies going through digital transformation. I think eventually, I could see that there was a much better way to be doing things. And I actually practiced some of those in leading, learning organizations for companies like Sun, Yahoo, and LinkedIn. And so I think over time it was an epiphany where, you know, yeah, there's definitely better ways to do this. And the book kind of emerged from that learning and that experience.
All right. So we should do some myth busting because that happens early in the book. Okay. So I'm going to throw some stuff out there. I want you to respond to it. How about the idea that there are right brain thinkers and left brain thinkers?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's, and the research we did for the book, I think that that's been a common language that people have used, though either I'm right brain or I'm left brain. It's this either or mentality. But the fact is that that's a myth, and that we use both the right and the left parts of our brains all the time, you know, so to especially to learn, that yeah. We use different parts of it to learn. So that's definitely a myth.
Yeah. And I know when I read Danny Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, the idea of like thinking about it like a system one, system two, a fast brain and a slow brain made much more sense with regard to how we encounter the world, how we form sort of biases that can be useful, and then how they can also become unuseful if they sort of get into a sort of fixed mindset. So it seems to me that we were really done a great disservice, and a lot of very creative, smart people were done a disservice by this sort of right brain, left brain thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the other thing I'd add is Todd Rose at the Harvard Business School, and he runs the Mind Education and Brain program there, and he talks a lot about this idea that that we think that people who learn faster or are smarter. Uh-huh. And that's absolutely a myth as well, and that the standardized tests were based on that notion. So there's a time table there, you know, like if you can't finish the test within 90 minutes or however long the test is, that means if we give you more time, it's not going to make a difference. That was the idea. And the truth is that sometimes you will take, some people do take longer, and it doesn't have anything to do with how intelligent you are. And in fact, more deep learners tend to take more time.
Yeah, that's Kahneman's slow brain, right? That's the sort of jury aspect of taking your time to deliberate over ideas. All right, how about this other idea that some people are sort of visual learners, some people are, you know, their optimal learning channels is, you know, auditory. Is that a thing? Is that a myth?
So that's been very controversial over the years, and through the research from the book, what we found was that although, and I can use myself as a good example here, I love listening to podcasts. It's something that I do, and I love to learn that way. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean that that's the only way I learn, or it's the best way I learn. It just means it's a preferred learning method that I use. But the fact is that we use all of our senses to learn, and that the best learning comes from a variety of sources. So it's that's another myth that I think is very prevalent in the world of work today.
Yeah. There was another one that popped up to me in your book when you write, quote, there's more than one pathway to mastery. And this is when I thought my academic friends and we know a lot of the same people or are citing a lot of the same work are so frustrated with Malcolm Gladwell because he's such a damn good storyteller. But this is a case in which those stories are not serving necessarily the truth. And stories are great. It is how we learn, in many ways, how we learn and how we make sense of the world. But also it makes for very easy shortcuts. And I think when you talk about this idea of mastery, it kind of refers to what you were talking about earlier, which is, yeah, for some people, that's going to take a long while. And for other people, they can have a shorter path. And some of it involves mentorship. And yes, there might be 1,000 hours, but that's never the thing alone. There's always, we tend to go so binary with this stuff when it's never as simple as one thing or another thing.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the things that David Blake, my co-author, and I have talked a lot about is this idea that, you know, there's a lot of ways to get educated in the world, and that there's a lot of different ways that we learn. But we tend to think about, you know, where we went to school or the companies that we worked for. So if I were to ask you, tell me about your education, most people would answer by where they went to university. But if you think about that, you know, many of us got our degrees, you know, many decades ago. And right. Yet, does that tell us what we really know or what we can do? Not so much. And so this idea that that there's only one way to get an education or one way to learn, or that the degree is the end all be all of everything, is really not serving us well. And I would say the same thing about career paths. You know, in the corporate world, people oftentimes will say, oh, well, what, you know, if I want to do what you do someday, what's my career path? Can you kind of map it out for me, or exactly what did you do? And what I'm finding most of the time when I talk to people is that more often than not, there's not, people have not followed a standard career path, that everybody's career path is very non-standard, as a matter of fact. So I'd say that it's the rare person who has a standardized career path.
Yeah, you have a great way of phrasing this in the book, where you wrote, quote, if you were to ask someone about their health and they told you that they ran a marathon 20 years ago, what would you think? And it's so ridiculous, yet that's exactly sort of like, well, I graduated from Harvard, and you're like, oh, okay, pass. And, you know, but what have you learned in the intervening time, especially as we live in an era where, you know, the science changes. I'm 52. I recall Freud being sort of like the thing. And then by the time I get out of college, it's like, oh, this is not the thing anymore. The whole bunch of the stuff has been disproved. And we don't, especially as we work into a work environment, we don't have sort of sustained learning programs. It's like you can go learn a program, you know, the Learn Excel. Or you're going to go do a ropes course, or you're going to take the seminar, but none of it has any sort of sustaining power.
Exactly. And I also think that if people believe that that whatever degree they got in college, if they got one, will sustain them throughout the entirety of their careers, they have to think again. And I don't care whether it's a new college graduate or whether it's someone mid-year or even late in their career. New things are emerging all the time, and so we have to be continuously learning if we expect to stay relevant in the workforce. And I think that's one of the big messages of the book, is this urgency to continuously learn and to reskill and upskill and cross-skill yourselves and take that upon yourselves to really do that.
Yeah, so let's dig into this. Let's dig into the idea of learning at work, because I think this is it's obviously a thing that we do at Second City. It has been your passion and your career. I thought this was a very telling phrase in the book, which is that, quote, information is rarely the key to resolving workplace issues. So can you help us unpack what that means?
Yeah, I think I use a few examples in the book, but a lot of people equate communicating information with training or learning. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one example I think is this idea of sexual harassment that, you know, we've been seeing a lot of that in the news. It's been a compliance type training that's been in corporations for decades. And this idea that if we just give people the information, that they will somehow then be, the knowledge will help them do things better in the future, where we actually know that's not true. You have to put your knowledge into practice and then reflect on it in order for it to become meaningful. Another example was at a prior company, there were a few managers that were making not so great hires into the company, and so there was this mandate: oh, let's send all of our managers to recruiting training, and so they'll know how to make better hires. But the fact of the matter is just conveying that information to people isn't going to make them better hiring managers. In fact, a lot of those managers actually already knew the basics about how to hire. It's just that they weren't putting them into practice or deciding they had a different idea about how they wanted to hire people. So just giving people knowledge does not actually help them do things differently.
So that really struck to me a couple of things. And one was that I've been thinking of this a lot about what we do in our work at Second City, because we're teaching sort of an improvisational mindset, right? We're taking you through these exercises that might seem unconnected to your workplace, but you sort of reveal it, the learning becomes the doing, right? You're doing it and you're sort of revealing, oh, okay, this is a way in which I can be more pro-social in my behavior to collaborate better or whatever. And I've been playing with this theory that at Second City, we're teaching teaching more wisdom than knowledge. We're not giving you dates or facts or other things to remember, but we're trying to give you wisdom for your actions. So if that means taking a beat before you say the first thing that comes in your mind, or if that means to lead by making your partner look good, these are the things that potentially can serve you as a skill. And our work, of course, is a practice. And that is, and I think there obviously what you talk a lot about, what's very effective is experiential learning, improvisation being one way to do that. But there's many other ways that you cite in the book of the way people have incorporated those kind of skills building through practice into their learning.
Right. And that's what I was going to say about what you all do at Second City. I mean, I think the key there is that you actually have people practice.
Yeah.
And then reflect on what they've actually done and connect the dots. Whereas a lot of training per se is just that, you know, lecture based talking at people. And I think that's the main difference.
I was thrilled to see we have a mutual friend, Emily Foote, who's in the book.
Yeah.
And you talk about she's got this company Practice, but it's based on work she did with her former law professor, Carl Okamoto, I think. And his model is really cool, right? It's this combination of small classes, sort of chunked topics, and the students kind of are forced to kind of learn themselves. They're not just given the learning. They have to sort of experience it.
Right. I loved interviewing Emily for the book, and what they're doing with Practice is it seems so simple, yet it's not done very often in either higher ed or corporate environments where you're actually asking people to do real problem solving in
right.
real work situations, actually practice things and then reflect on them and then talk about them with peers. I mean, that's a very powerful model, and it's proven, you know, that it really works. And so they've got something really great going there.
We should talk about some of your specific experiences, because I always think that that's good. We can talk about theories and academics and all that's great, but you had a career in which you sort of witnessed the good and the bad and the ugly. So you were at Sun Microsystems when Oracle purchased the company, and I want you to sort of talk us through, like, what was that like to be on the receiving end of a company like that coming in and taking over?
Yeah, that was a really interesting and more than interesting. I mean, it was an experience that for a lot of employees at Sun, like myself, that had been there for a lot of years, was really a difficult time. And, you know, I talk about the story of Sun a lot these days, because I think it sends a message that I'll talk about in a second. But, you know, I was at Sun for a little over 20 years, and I had several careers there: product development, corporate strategy, and that's where I entered into the learning field when I was at Sun. And the change at Sun happened. It seemed kind of sudden in a lot of ways. I mean, at one point, Sun was, you know, at the top of its game, the titan of the tech industry, going against, you know, companies like HP and IBM and Microsoft. And then, you know, one year we were valued at $65 billion, and the next year Oracle bought us for a little over $7 billion. And
wow.
That, so I think what happened was is that we weren't quite prepared. I think we got a little bit complacent, weren't quite keeping up with the trends of where the markets were going. We didn't adjust. We didn't reinvent ourselves. And so for the employees who absolutely loved being there and working there and being a part of that amazing culture, it was really tough. And Oracle was a very different culture for a lot of us. It wasn't really compatible with, you know, who we were, where we spent time at so many years at Sun. So I think it was, and I say in the book too, you know, for a lot of people when they join a company, a lot of times they think about the culture fit, you know, how will I fit into the culture of that company? What's their vision? What's their mission? What are their values? And when you're acquired by another company, you don't necessarily get to make those choices the same way. You know, your company's bought, you become part of that company, and then you either decide you can adjust and you do like that company and that culture, or you go do something else.
Yeah, and it's the sort of prophetic nature of, you know, when Sun kind of goes away and Facebook takes over that campus. And they, is this true that they kept the Sun sign facing the Facebook?
Yes.
That's wild.
The story around that is, and I actually have a picture of that. If you go to the Facebook campus right now in Menlo Park, on the one side is the Facebook logo, and on the other side, they kept the Sun logo on the back side of the Facebook signage, and with the explicit message to their employees, we want Sun's logo to stay there for the message that it sends to employees. Don't get complacent. Don't think that we don't have to continually reinvent ourselves to stay relevant in the future.
Wow, so powerful.
It's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And it makes sense. That's a nudge that I think makes sense. So you've spent a lot of time in the technology industry, and one of the things I really loved about this book, which is you don't shy away from talking about how technology can improve learning, but what you also sort of explore is like it is not replacing live learning aspects. That in itself is a myth, that suddenly we're all going to just learn from computer and from digital means. And I thought this was interesting. You say, and you're quoting Angela Arendts, I hope I'm saying that right, who was with Burberry and then Apple. And she writes, quote, "The more technologically advanced our society becomes, the more we need to go back to the basic fundamentals of human communication." So talk about that tension, the tension between the need for sort of face-to-face human interaction as learning goes, and also the recognition that there are these sort of digital avenues open to us which can enhance our learning.
Right. I mean, I work for an education technology company right now, Degreed, but I would be the first to tell you that technology isn't going to be the end all be all of all learning, because I firmly believe that. And when I talk about lecture-based learning not being very effective, what I often tell people is that I'm not against, it's not that I'm against in-person learning. I just don't like this lecture model where people sit there passively and listen to other people talk about what they should know. Instead, this idea that you can blend technology with in-person learning, and it doesn't have to be an either-or proposition. And I think that's where we tend to go a lot of times. It's either, you know, it's one extreme or the other. And when online learning first came into play a couple of decades ago, people were saying, oh, that's going to replace everything. Well, that's not true, and neither is in-person learning adequate either. I think we need a combination of both. So I would say that some of the most effective learning that I've seen is where you get people, especially team-based learning, and you get people at work solving real problems together, and then you can use technology either as part of that in person or as follow on to what you learned while you were together. And ideally, it's a combination of both over time. So at LinkedIn, for example, we created an online 4-week learning program around conscious business values and learning soft skills over time, practicing them. Like, how do you have difficult conversations, and how do you go out and do that? And then can you come back into your peer group using technology to actually talk about how that experience went and what you learned and reflected on it and get feedback from your peers? So you're actually doing something real at work that means something, not something that's just theoretical, but something you actually really need to do. You don't make things up to do it, and then you actually reflect on that experience. That's the most effective learning in my view, something that blends those two very nicely.
Yeah, we just collaborated with Kim Scott, who wrote the book Radical Candor, which is an amazing book. And Kim's got, you know, a wonderful sort of grid that she lays out about what can be effective feedback. And by adding sort of experiential Second City exercises and games where people can try on the different modes, it really, we just led our first workshop with this and we're like, oh, this is great. It's the best of both worlds, because they have this knowledge that they can get ahead of time if they've read the book. They have her podcast and other things to reflect on afterwards. But in the room, we're going to play with it. We're going to play with saying it wrong, saying it right, saying it through ruinous empathy or manipulative insincerity. And by doing that, we can basically, it makes us so much more empathetic communicators because we felt what it feels like to deliver a certain kind of news a certain kind of way and or receive that.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's a great model. And I think, you know, the reality of learning is that people learn when they care about something or when they need to actually do something. And I think where we miss the mark a lot is by sending people to this one size fits all training or learning and then hoping that someday they'll need it. And the fact is that if you've got a big presentation that you need to, you found yourself on the agenda of the executive team meeting and you need to really hone your presentation skills, you're not going to wait 3 weeks until there's a presentation skills class to take, right? You want learning when you need it. And so I think that's another big key to really making learning effective is are you providing it when people need it? And that's where technology and all the content that's out there right now really comes into play, is because now there's so much information at our fingertips. And when you do need something, technology can play a huge role in helping you find the best and the most relevant content for you at the time of need.
Yeah, we mentioned Emily Foote earlier in her company Practice, which is this very cool way of sort of practicing feedback through taping yourself, delivering the feedback, sharing it peer-to-peer, taking notes. And what we know sort of from academic circles around feedback is for beginners, they just really need support. And they need encouragement. That's giving them too much instruction early doesn't do anything. But as you begin to develop in your career, you do need more challenges. But that feedback will only work if it's coming from a place of sort of care and that you know it's coming from a good place where people want you to succeed. The minute it becomes punitive, the learning stops. People do not learn when they are unhappy.
I couldn't agree more. And one of the other things that I think is important to note is that our more traditional models of learning in the workplace have been tied to performance, you know, performance reviews, and let me tell you how you're doing at work, and oh, by the way, here's a few things you need to improve on, and so go learn about it. It seems very punitive, and instead, if you think about learning in terms of people's career aspirations, I mean, if you talk to anyone, whether they're a new college grad or mid-career or later in their career, everybody wants to do better at either get better at the job that they already have or prepare themselves for their next adventure or their next career choice. So if you think about learning in terms of career aspirations rather than punitive performance reviews, I think that you'll get people much more excited about learning. And I think one of the biggest things that I was hoping to, you know, really get across with the book is that people really do love to learn. It's just that they need to learn on, you know, if you go back to Dan Pink's book on drive, motivation, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, if you give people some level of control over what they're learning and if they really care about it, people do love to learn. But we've created this environment where it's much more command and control, and so people have lost their enjoyment of learning, and it's really sad. And so we're hoping to bring a bit of that love of learning back into the workplace.
Yeah, that's great. All right, and so we're going to ask you in a second for your Yes And story as we sort of come to a close in the podcast, but there is one other thing I wanted to talk to you about, because you tell a story in the book about when you were at LinkedIn, and you were supporting one of your up-and-coming employees who actually got a kind of a cool offer for another company. And your sort of thing around that was, look, in many companies, they would just try whatever they can to keep them, but sometimes just letting someone go to another opportunity is absolutely the right thing to do, not just for that person, but also for you and your company in terms of the payoff that might come later down the line.
Yeah, and, you know, I learned that early on in my career when I was at Sun. That was kind of the model we followed there, was always, you know, help people with their careers. And that may mean, you know, I told you I had at least three different careers while I was at Sun, and it was with that same thing in mind. It's like, oh, managers who kind of hoard their talent are not doing anyone a service. And so this idea that you can actually help people with their careers. And, you know, if you have an open dialogue with them about what it is they want to do and how they want to progress in their careers, and then if a new opportunity comes up, of course, in a story in the book, I talk about the fact that I would have loved to have kept that person on my team, but the next role for that person was actually my job, and I wasn't leaving anytime soon. And so, you know, she got that opportunity, and it was great. You know that something's working well when somebody can come to you when they work for you and tell you about another opportunity and say, right, "Can we talk about this?" And I was like, "Wow, that's a compliment," you know, to me that person felt good enough to do that. And to your point, you know, this idea that, you know, that now, now that person will always think great of the company, you know, that we worked at LinkedIn. Who knows, maybe one day she'll go back there, or maybe when we work together again. I mean, there's a lot of ways that that can be beneficial. But the thing is that people are the best brand ambassadors for your company. So think about how you treat them as you're recruiting them, as you're developing them, and even as they're leaving. I mean, that can be a big message to how they talk about your company after they leave.
Yeah, this is something certainly I learned at Second City, because I can't tell you how many agents or managers, especially early in my career, like in the 90s and early 2000s, were like, you know, you should own your talent, you should, you know, manage them, or, you know, have some sort of economic interest because you train all these people. And, you know, it is anathema to the culture at Second City to do that. And then you look at, like, well, when Tina Fey goes on Jimmy Fallon or, you know, Letterman or whatever it was, and talks about her incredible time at Second City, what does that do for the company compared to trying to take 10%? I think it's proven itself over time in terms of the legacy of our organization, which has done this from the beginning, right? It has done nothing but let its best talent go. But then, you know, as far as marketing and advertising, there could not be better marketing or advertising than another one of these people becoming successful and talking about their time at the theater.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right. So it is time. We're already living in Second City. We just talked about it, for a yes and story. So this is how we always finish the podcast. And the idea in improvisation is you can't say no if you're going to further a scene. And you can't just stop at saying yes. You have to say yes and. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I do. My yes and I'm hoping I'm understanding the question right, but when I was thinking about when was a time where I was where I was going to say no, but then I ended up saying yes.
Yep.
Is that how it works?
Yeah. Yep.
So I was VP of learning at Yahoo, and I got this email from LinkedIn asking me if I would come to talk to them about a role that they had. They hadn't created a learning organization yet, and that would I be interested to come and have lunch with them and talk about that role. And it's so interesting, because I really was not looking for another position, and I was really happy at Yahoo at that time. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, making progress with a lot of the initiatives we had going. I agreed to have lunch, and I almost canceled,
yeah,
to have the lunch to talk about the opportunity. And then I ended up going, and I said, yes, I ended up going and having lunch, talking about the opportunity, and over a series of a few months, ended up taking the opportunity to start a learning organization from scratch at LinkedIn, where I spent, you know, 4 years of my career. And so it was a good experience, and I learned that, wow, that could have really changed my life if I hadn't have said yes.
Yeah, how often, you know, we never sort of, like, after one of those things go, I never should have had that lunch or that coffee. You almost always find, even if it's like, hey, you had a decent meal that someone picked up. I mean, it's like, we don't rue those moments. We rue the moments where we don't act.
Exactly. And I think that's how I thought about it when I went. I said, well, you know, I love learning about what new companies were doing at the time. LinkedIn wasn't that, you know, it was known, but not as well known as it is today.
Yeah.
And so, I thought, well, if I can just even learn more about what that company is doing, that will be worth my time having lunch. And then look what happened. So that's my yes and story.
I love it. The book is called The Expertise Economy. Economy. You can get it at Amazon. It's all over the internet. Pick it up. Kelly Palmer, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I've been working in a home.